I went to college down on the edge of the Ozarks in southwest Missouri, which, of course, all of you probably know is just a beautiful place, the Ozarks. I love being in the Ozarks with its trees and its bluffs and its rivers. But after college, I moved to Waco. Yeah, some of you might have been there. My first impression of Texas was just how ugly it was. Waco in particular is actually a pretty poor and dumpy little town, and the landscape of central Texas is dry and hot. It's the semi-arid climate with these gnarly trees and scrubby brush and bushes. It was kind of depressing for me the first year. Back in college, one of the things that I loved to do on a nice spring day would be to lay down on the warm green grass in the sun on my backpack as a pillow and just soak up the sun. And I would even take naps out in the middle of the grass there. But in Texas, when I moved to Texas and I tried to lay down on the grass, fire ants started attacking me. So the first spiritual truth I learned while being in seminary was this: there is something demonic about Texas. Jesse and I, while we were there, we became close friends with a couple who were also new to Texas. They were from northern Wisconsin, where there are these beautiful summers with beautiful lakes and pine forests and stunning snows in the wintertime. My friend Josh, he was also convinced that Texas was Satan's territory because to him, every August felt like we were living in the fires of hell. So he and I, we both took every chance we could get to tell Texans just how awful their state is. Now, if you know anything about Texans, you know they have a little too much pride in their state. It's actually kind of weird. So this little bit of truth-telling about the woes of living in Texas was never well received. In fact, there was this one native Texan who was always trying to convince me of otherwise how great Texas is. What about the hill country of central Texas? I know it's kind of scrubby, but it's beautiful in its own way. And what about the live oaks? You don't have live oaks in Missouri, and he's right. For those of you who don't know, live oaks, they're very different than the pine or the pin oaks and the white oaks we have around here. White oaks, they have these tiny little leaves that are sort of waxy, and they're really numerous, and they're really hard to rake up, and they grow in these really slow, creepy, gnarly kind of ways with arms that are twisted and bent, kind of like what you would see in a horror movie. His beautiful trees are the trees of most people's nightmares. So it took me a while. But after several years of living there, I did begin to see it. There really is a beauty to those trees. The way they grow, there's this age and wisdom and character to the trees there that we just don't have here in Missouri. And my friend Josh doesn't have in Wisconsin. And it wasn't just the live oaks, really. In fact, the longer I lived in Waco, the more I had to start to admit, you know, there are some really beautiful places here, places that I hadn't noticed before. The landscape is fundamentally different than anything I had known, but it has its own sacred shapes and contours, which brings us to your soul. The landscape of your soul is most certainly unique. It may be full of twisted, gnarly trees or flowing Ozark streams. It may be semi-arid. It may be packed with cold snow of the northern woods, but there in the landscape of your soul is exactly the place where God can be found. It's a strange mystery for us, but saints across the ages have been saying this. They've discovered the same reality over and over again, hidden there in the contours of your soul, in its longings and in its desires and its restlessness. There is the house of God, the gate of heaven, to use Jacob's words. And at one very important level, that's what Genesis 28 is trying to help us to see. This moment here in Jacob's life, it comes sort of midway in his adult life. He's actually not met Rachel and Leah yet, but he is at least in his 40s by now. He's already manipulated his older brother Esau. He's deceived his dying daddy Isaac. He's stolen the family birthright. Esau, his brother, is threatening his life, and so Mama Rebekah sends Jacob away with absolutely nothing. Jacob is on the run. And he's headed to this distant relative that he's probably never met, and he's alone, and he's got a whole lot of nothing with him. No supplies, no tent, no sleeping bag, nothing to lay his head on except for some stone he finds on the ground. After all those years of scheming and planning and trying to come out on top, this is where Jacob finds himself on this day. And so he lays his head on that hard pillow and hits rock bottom. And he falls asleep with his life in shambles. He didn't even have a cell phone to interrupt his sermons. I mean, he had nothing. He had nothing, I'm telling you. And so he falls asleep, and it's quiet. There's crickets. And his soul is wrestling and churning. And out of that churning in his soul, he has this dream. This dream where he sees what's been there all along. It's a dream where the ladder goes into heaven with angels ascending and descending. It's a dream really about a passageway, an opening to the divine presence, this connection to God. And suddenly out of nowhere, he sees and realizes that God is actually right there, right next to Jacob, speaking and revealing and blessing. I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of your grandpa, the God of your daddy. Know that I am with you, and I will keep you wherever you go. I am with you. Now, as best as I can tell, this is the first real encounter that Jacob has with this God. He's probably heard Isaac talk about God along the way. Maybe he's thought about God on and off, but this is different. This is the first time Jacob encounters a personal presence. And this encounter, it bubbles up out of the churning landscape of his soul, so that when he awakes, he says, well, surely God is in this place, and I didn't know it. And on the surface of that statement, he is, of course, talking about a particular geographic location, the landscape there before him. And so he takes the rock that was his pillow, and he anoints it with oil, marks it as this holy place, and he names that spot Bethel. Bethel means the house of God. And this place, this location, Bethel, becomes really important throughout the rest of the Old Testament story. It comes up again and again, and it's recognized as this holy place, this place where you can come and you can encounter God. But something happens. Along the way, the tone changes, and the prophets begin to criticize Bethel rather than praise Bethel and all that it represents. Because as the generations pass, a shift begins to happen. A shift where Bethel is no longer a place where the soul can be awakened to God, but it's a place that begins to be defined by expectation and obligation and rituals. In other words, the soul encounter is lost. And when that happens, the meaning of Jacob's words are lost. So when Jacob says, surely the Lord is in this place, he's describing a reality that's about more than the rocks and the hard ground there around him. He's describing something about the landscape of his soul, the rocks and the hard ground within him. This place where there is wrestling and longing and a place of feeling unsettled, a place where there's often dryness, a place where the passions rise in him. See, the landscape of the soul is the place where there is this hidden ladder, this unknown opening to God. And in the rarest moments of grace, you might suddenly realize that God is actually there, speaking, revealing, blessing. God is there. A few weeks ago, I was running in Queenie Park, just a few miles from here. And when I run, I like to listen to podcasts because it helps me not think about how I just want to stop running. And so lately, I've been listening to these podcasts from On Being. And on this particular day, I was listening to an interview with John O'Donohue, this Irish Celtic poet, writer, philosopher. And about halfway through the interview, O'Donohue mentioned that what he loves about Christianity and where he differs from other religious traditions is that at the heart of Christianity, we have this idea of intimacy. Intimacy with God, which he says is true belonging. It's being seen. It's the home of individuation. In other words, it's that ultimate place of being personally, individually known. And then he brings up that old line from St. Augustine, this phrase where Augustine says, God is more intimate to me than I am to myself. God is more intimate to me than I am to myself. God is more present to my soul than even I am. And the only way that's possible then is if God is the one who is abiding deep in the mystery of my soul. There in the landscape of the soul is the home of God. And all the longings of the soul is really ultimately a longing for God, a longing to know the God who has already struck you with a wound of love. That's how St. John of the Cross describes it anyway. John of the Cross says, we've been wounded by God. Do you remember what it's like to feel wounded by love, to be lovesick, to wonder again when you might see your beloved? I remember my college graduation day was a bit like that. The last 2 years of college, Jesse and I had flirted and dated and broken up and dated again. And finally, a few weeks before graduation, I told her something I'd never told another woman before. I said those three sacred words, I love you. And I meant it. And I finally knew that I wanted to spend the rest of my life with her. But on graduation day, everything was changing. See, her older sister was graduating from another college in a different place, and so she had to leave early that morning, and her leaving was the beginning of this great uncertain separation for us. So it wasn't just graduation day. After graduation, I was headed to Mexico for the summer, and when I got back from Mexico, I was moving to Texas to start seminary in the fall, and she wasn't coming with me. She had two more years of school left here in Missouri, and I didn't know how all this was going to work itself out. But I knew that day was the beginning of everything changing. It was the beginning of not seeing her for who knows how long. And my heart just ached on that day. This woman that I'd fallen in love with and that had been a part of my everyday life was not going to be a part of my everyday life for a long time. So early that morning, we woke up and met one another at a local restaurant to have breakfast together. And after we'd had breakfast, we said our goodbyes, and I stood there watching her drive away, and I can remember it so well, watching her car drive away, and my eyes started to fill with tears, and my heart just ached. That's what John of the Cross is describing when he says, we've been wounded by God. It's this wound of love, and that wound of love is where all the longings of your life come from. It's where the restlessness that we live with that pops up again and again comes from. Our souls have been wounded by the love of God, and your soul is longing for her beloved, wondering when she will rest in the embrace of her lover again. And your spiritual life, your spirituality, it's really what you're doing with that longing. Because we do all sorts of different things with that longing. We redirect it in all kinds of ways, some good, some not so good. But we take our longing and our restlessness and we throw it into our careers sometimes, trying to be more successful, trying to be on top of our game. Or we live out those longings and that restlessness, sometimes by chasing another experience or chasing another relationship or chasing a new adventure. Sometimes we live it out by trying to find meaning in this world by doing something that will outlast us, by fixing the world in some ways. We live it out in all kinds of different ways. Jacob lived out his restless desires by trying to get on top of his game with his family. And so it led to his scheming and his manipulating of his loved ones. All that was part of his spirituality. All of it was part of his life being lived from restlessness, this longing for something more. A longing that came to him, even though he didn't know it, from being wounded by God's deep love for him. And you know, in those moments, when all that longing and that restlessness comes to the surface, like those moments when we have hit rock bottom. Or maybe those moments when we've just failed miserably, or we've experienced some kind of loss. Or maybe just when life is not enough to keep us happy anymore. It's in those moments that your soul is trying to say to you, what you're looking for is God. And you've been looking for God out there all the time in all these places when all along God has been hiding deep within you. Jacob falls asleep, and out of the landscape of his soul, there's this opening to the divine presence, a ladder that reaches up into the heavens. And when he awakes, he sees and knows what he didn't see before. Surely the Lord is in this place. And it's not surprising that Jacob didn't see it. No one would have guessed it about Jacob. I mean, from the outside, the landscape of his life looks pretty arid and gnarly and dry. But the good news is that God does not hang out in just pristine landscapes. God is there in the unique beauty and the tragedy and the cracks and the crevices of your own soul. So if you want to see God, and if you want to know God, if you want to find God, then learn to listen to your longings and allow those longings to lead you inward, to carry you deeper and deeper into the wild landscape of your soul until you glimpse that place where God is hidden. And there, when you glimpse that, may you find rest in the arms of your beloved. Amen.